no, they're still coming. And he would keep telling me, okay, now they're near Mexico City, you know, now they're near, you know, he kept monitoring them. They kept coming. And it was amazing to me that everything that people knew, all the deterrence, all the threats, all the fears of what could happen, she still chose to come. And she still felt it, my chances, because I already know what's going to happen to me if I go back, for a fact, that even if I'm in detention, even if I'm separated from my child, at least maybe my child has a chance of living, and so do I. And so she still pursued it, and they still came. So it was amazing to me to see that, because I thought, you know, they've really ramped it up now at the border. So this is, you know, this really failed policy of deterrence, this militarized approach to immigration, which is just not going to work. And it's an incredible waste of resources and of human life. And we know that there can be another way. We know that there can be a way that is humane, where we can accept people who are seeking protection, which is their right under the United Nations, where that people can be reunited with their families, and that where we can address root causes so people don't have to leave in the first place, that we can support people in the popular struggle to defend their territory, to fight for democracy, to fight for their right to sustain themselves and feed their own families right where they belong, right where they live, you know, right where they'd like to be.
Very compelling arguments. Again, that's the voice of Reverend Deborah Lee, Executive Director of Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity, based in Oakland, California. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank you for joining us and sharing your views here on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much.
It's 11 o'clock. It's 11 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 1101, actually. And it's time for the Burt Dirtbag, so stay tuned. KBOO Portland.
That's a good line there from that intro song. It's alarming how charming it is to be a farming.
That's right. Just came from the farm this very moment, like 45 minutes ago.
That's Jim Gilbert here beside me. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you until about 12 noon. We may be expecting an interruption for the emergency broadcast test.
Uh-huh.
Sometime between 11 and 1, no. 10 and 1 or something like that.
You know, the last time I heard that, it wasn't a very good interruption. I mean, the broadcast was terrible. You couldn't hear what they were saying or anything. It was like, I'm glad it wasn't an emergency, because it was...
Maybe that's why they do these, maybe, Dave.
Right.
Figure things like that out.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've got a Prunus-centered show today.
Mm.
Maybe. Normally, we would have our garden stumper half past the hour, but I'm going to maybe just lay it on first because it's related to our plant of the month.
Okay.
Plants of the month.
Okay.
Which is peaches and nectarines. We also have, we talk about this every year, but I think it's important because you should harvest things at their peak. That's where the flavor is.
And that's why you can grow them at home. And that's where it's a better place.
If you want produce that's not at the peak, then you go to the grocery market, the grocery store.
Right. They want produce that will store for months and look ripe. And, you know, that's where it is.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that since the harvest season is upon us. It's not hot and heavy yet, but it's certainly here. And I need to print this larger when I forget my glasses.
Yeah.
So I can read it.
Right. And darker so I can read it.
Oh, yeah. And let's see here. What does that say there? Harvesting at the peak for flavor. Yes, right. Then, our Dirtbag Dictionary terms.
Yes.
Apical dominance.
Yes, I'm sure everybody out there is really aware of that word, those two words.
Right, and we'll look at that there, too. We've got, I'm going to talk about pruning espaliered fruit, and that ties right in with maybe it's going to be a new segment that we have here. What's annoying Glenn this month? I know it may be tough to limit it to one, but I've got one, one that's related to that today.
Okay, well, we'll have at least for today have a new segment, right?
Yes. Right. And then, of course, Jim's been on the go, visiting New Jersey, of all places. A hotbed for apricots?
In a hot and humid place.
Is that why they can grow apricots there, or do they?
They grow it well. It's not a big commercial crop there, but we visited an experiment station where they have a great collection of them. Exciting, really. It was really, really fun. And I think apricots are typically grown in a dry, hot climate.
Yeah, Eastern Oregon, for example.
Yeah, and New Jersey doesn't qualify for that. That's why we're excited about those varieties we find there, because they hopefully will do well here.
So the trees grow, but do they produce fruit?
I ate more apricots than I could handle.
Oh, say no more, Jim.
Yes.
Yeah. And what's going on the farm? And I don't know if we talked about why we may want to paint trunks last month.
I don't think we got to it.
Well, I had that on there, and so that's one thing to do. So Tammy's unaware of this, but I'm going to just hit you with the garden stumper right now. So we don't have our theme. She's busy, engrossed in conversation. So
hopefully with somebody calling with a really important question.
Speaking of calling, one may.
Yes.
At 503-231-8187. We're here for your gardening questions. We're going to branch out at some point, too, and take other questions.
Like?
Life.
Really?
Well, between the two of us, we're over 100. Well, a little more than that.
Yeah. Life on a hippie commune. What other?
Sure. Sure. If anybody's doing that, we'll do it. So the stumper today is, and this is, maybe it's too easy for some people, but since our plants of the month are peaches and nectarines, the question is, what fruits are crossed to make a nectarine? Okay, that's the question. What fruits are crossed to make a nectarine? So, if you have the answer to that, 503-231-8187. Let's talk about harvesting at peak here, so we'll give a chance for some answers to roll in here, and maybe some questions, too. What would you say about that? Coming up next, harvesting is probably figs. Maybe my figs are in 2016. My notes told me that I had already harvested figs at this point.
Well, it's early for us. We usually figure the end of July, so we got a couple more weeks before Desert King is a typical Braba crop fig, early crop fig.
You're right.
Yeah, so it's probably a week and a half to 2 weeks away, I would guess.
But it's a starting point anyway, because people's figs will be coming ripe. They don't ripen on the tree. They don't ripen off the tree. They only ripen on the tree.
And that's what makes them so wonderful and so difficult to ship, and why we should grow them here, because the ones from California, while they look like figs, they taste like figs.
Yeah. And they they get pretty soft on the tree, too. And they may soften up a little bit off the tree, but they're not going to ripen anymore.
No more sweetness. And
that's right.
And that's what we're picking them for. So when they droop, they kind of stick out when they're not ripe, and they start to droop and they get soft. And that's when they're getting to their peak.
And they also start turning a whiter shade of pale. No, excuse me, a yellower shade of green.
Yes, that's right.
And that's a telltale sign. Plus, when they fall on the ground and go splat.
Yeah, or ants get in them, or birds eat them. I mean, there's a lot of other signs, too, because we're not the only ones that relish figs.
That's right. Okay, Deanna
Yes.
Going to the phones. You have a question or an answer for us?
Well, I'm afraid this is an embarrassing question. I should know the answer to it, but Glenn, you have bees and you have blueberries.
Yes.
So I'm counting on the fact that you will absolutely shame me to death and tell me what this is. The bees, I think it's the bees because I caught a bee in the act, it looked like, of sticking a little thing inside each blueberry, a little parcel, furled up very nicely, brownish red in color, about a quarter of an inch in length. And I thought it was happening only in the ripe blueberries, but I actually saw one sticking out of a greenish looking blueberry this morning. And by the way, those berries are giving well over a quart and a half a day.
Well, that's another fruit we could talk about, picking at their peak. But a bee? And what is the... I'm not convinced it's a bee.
Well, okay, it may not be a bee. It may have been coincidental, you know, circumstantial evidence. There was the bee just dancing around this blueberry, and then... But it looked very much to me as though, because I really watched, he was poking these things into that, you know, the center of the blueberry. And there...
Pardon me for interrupting, but from the mouth part or from the abdomen part?
From the... Good question. Mouth part, I would say. I mean, I don't remember watching that carefully. That's
well, one of our big problems that we have in the city, I don't think Jim has been hit with this yet, but is the spotted winged Drosophila fruit fly.
Uh-huh.
And I you can see him. I mean, I see him every morning.
Does it look at all like a bee?
No, it looks like a fruit fly.
Yeah, no. This was a bee.
Yeah.
Of some kind.
It might have been attracted by the juice that was something else had damaged the fruit, and it was...
Well, the fruit doesn't ever look damaged. I just pull those little things right out, wash those blueberries.
Well,
that's a puzzler.
It is a puzzler.
It is. I thought for sure you'd say, Fiona,
you should bring one of those little things to somebody who might...
Or take a photo of it.
Yeah.
And send that to me.
That would be easy. I'll do that.
Okay.
And I just have one quick comment, and maybe this is something you'll be happy to discuss. I don't know. When you came last fall, I think, or whenever it was, to my place, and we looked at the blueberry bushes together, you said, okay, because I was saying, please tell me how to prune these, and you said, okay, cut the ones that already gave blueberries this year at the end of February, I think it is, right?
Oh, that's about time, yeah.
Yeah, and I made my notes. And while I was having trouble, I mean, I think you showed me at the time, see, these had blueberries, these didn't. Boy, by the end of February, there was no way I could tell who had blueberries and who hadn't had blueberries. So all I did was trim out every single tiny twig of dead wood and just let them go. And so I wanted maybe you to comment about that.
Okay.
If you can. Okay?
Sure.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Well, I look forward to the photo. It's very, that would be unlikely for a bee to be, you know, sipping juices now. They just can't be that sweet yet.
Right.
And there's plenty of other sources of sweeter nectar as far as they're concerned, for bees. But I don't know.
Yep.
I don't know that. I mean, that's small on the blueberry itself. Now, if it could have been some, if it was the abdomen that was poking it, you know, it might have been laying an egg in it, in the blueberry.
But that wouldn't normally be. It wouldn't be a honeybee doing that.
No. It certainly wasn't a honeybee if it was only a quarter of an inch long.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, that's what she said. Or maybe she said an eighth of an inch, but pretty small. So I'm just waiting. I'll wait for the photo.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll get that there. Now, as far as pruning blueberries, we'll talk about this more in the fall, but I hope I didn't misspeak, but what I recommend is just cutting out the oldest couple of canes from the center of the bush or wherever they happen to be, because the blueberries are most productive on 2 to 4 year old canes. So you don't really you don't want to cut out the brand new canes right away, but the oldest ones, that would be easy, cut those out. But what she did too, cutting out all the dead wood, that's wonderful because it gets more air circulation through there, more sunshine, and maybe she's pruning out some live wood too, which would be fine.
Yeah. You know, weak wood.
Yes.
You know, which would be good.
Right. Okay. Colin. Colin's calling. You probably hear that all the time.
Hello, hello?
Yep, you're on.
I have a cannabis question.
Oh, boy. All right.
Well, it could be a tomato question. It could be almost anything. But
okay, thank you.
I raised, in 2-gallon pots, I've raised 4 from seed, and I don't know exactly. I think they're all females. But what I'm wondering is about under or over watering. Is my question, because they've gotten to be about 2 feet tall and they're kind of spindly and they're really healthy, but the leaves and some even in the middle of the plant are starting to yellow, and I use basically black gold potting mix with a little bit of mixture of it's pretty good. It's a not very heavy. It doesn't have any sand or anything in it.
Well, it doesn't also have very many nutrients. So you've hit the nail here on the head. I mean, some, but it's when you're growing in pots, whether it's tomatoes or pot, you really should be mixing in a little bit of fertilizer when you plant it too.
Uh-huh.
Because it's not dirt that has natural nutrients just in the rocks or just in the soil.
Well, I did mix some dirt out of my compost pile, which has been composting for years. So I've got some dirt in there, but...
Well, yeah, compost is not dirt either. So when I, if I'm going to grow in a pot, I usually mix in maybe a third of just native soil.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you could put a third of your compost and a third of the potting mix or something like that.
So what about the over or under watering?
Well, how often do you water it?
Well, I've given it probably a 1/2 gallon every 2 days, once every couple days.
Does it have drainage holes?
Yes.
Surface of the soil greenish, moldy?
No.
Good.
No, it's not.
Good.
Yeah.
How do you determine whether it needs water or not?
Well, that's the problem. That's why I'm calling you.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we do at the nursery is we do it by gravity, essentially, by weight. And you can determine when you have a pot that's well watered and, you feel like its water is coming out of the drain holes. You've soaked the soil. That's maximum water. And as it gets drier, it will get lighter and lighter.
Yeah.
And as it if you get to the point where you start seeing wilt, which you probably don't need to do that, but as it gets lighter, that's when you can get a sense of when you pick the pot up. With only 4 pots, it's easy to pick them up. Then water them when they get significantly lighter than that.
And so you think I'm underwatering them, and the soil isn't dense enough to hold the moisture?
Well, that is one drawback of potting soil and compost, is that it's just by itself does not retain water very well.
Okay. Well, I'll start mixing in some dirt.
Well, you can't really do that now, of course, but...
And for our purposes, like going back to we grow thousands of plants in pots, we don't use soil in our potting mix. We use just a potting mix, made primarily with bark and peat moss.
Now I'm really confused.
Yeah.
But
Glenn and I Glenn and I do things differently because he's not growing, thousands of plants in pots. It wouldn't be practical to do it in that scale using regular native soil.
But you must add nutrients, Jim?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely is either we either use an organic fertilizer, which you can purchase, I can't remember some of the names of them, but they're
right.
Cottonseed meal and different things you can use, or you can use like Osmocote or something, a slow release chemical fertilizer. But
I'm using that Lily Miller 5-10-10 vegetable tomato food.
Is that in a powder form?
Yeah, it's in a, granular.
Granular.
Powder, granular. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you might try...
Something liquid, huh?
Yes. And the yellowing leads me to believe that it may not be getting enough nitrogen, although you said that that it's getting kind of spindly, which means there might be too much nitrogen.
Theory is still out. All right, you guys.
All right.
Work on it.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Yeah. Anissa, good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hi there. Yes. I have a peach question.
All right.
And there's a tiny little town in the middle of central Oregon called Kimberly.
Yep.
I know it.
And I have heard that there are big, huge, beautiful, juicy peaches from there. And I'm wondering if you have to drive all the way to 200 miles out there to taste one. And if you do, has anybody tasted one? And can you tell me what it tastes like compared to other juicy sweet peaches?
Well, Jim, you seem to...
Have you heard of the Kimberly?
So I know where Kimberly is, and I know, actually, an old friend of mine lived there for a while, and I know that there's fruit grown there. And
that's near
John Day? John Day, that area.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There, you know, you don't need to be in Kimberly to grow a large, juicy, sweet peach. You don't have to drive that far to get one. Interestingly, if you drive up the Columbia River, I know this because I just did it, to Highway 97, Biggs Junction, go across the Mary Hill Bridge, but you go across the bridge toward Mary Hill. On the other side of the bridge is a produce stand. And right there along the river are some orchards of apricots and peaches, and you can get some pretty nice fruit there. So it's closer. But, I mean, what you're really talking about, of course, is the difference in climate between Kimberly and Canby, for example.
Well, that's good,
and,
Jim.
Yeah.
Good and, alliteration there.
Yeah, right. And you can grow nice peaches here in the Willamette Valley. The important thing is to choose your variety, because the ones they grow in Kimberly are not going to be susceptible to peach leaf curl like the ones that you grow here because of our rainy springs. But you can grow a nice, juicy, sweet peach here. Probably not maybe quite as good as you can do in Kimberly, but a pretty good one.
I believe you. I'm just wondering if you have tasted a Kimberly peach.
My guess is that Kimberly peaches are probably not any different than Maryhill peaches. I think that they're all, there are certain peach varieties that people grow on the east side of the mountains, and I don't think Kimberly is going to be any different than some of the Yakima or Maryhill or other places.
Yeah, so that's just a rumor that I heard about the famous Kimberly peach.
I think it's the Kimberly Chamber of Commerce that probably has something to do with that. But.
Okay.
Well, okay. I have a friend who, he's retired, but he's been doing it for decades. He's in Helvetia, just on the west side. He has a commercial peach orchard over there,
mm-hmm.
and now he's even canning them. I mean, commercially canning them.
Wow, well, yeah.
But
where is Helvetia?
Oh, it's Hillsboro area.
Hillsboro.
West side.
Okay. Yeah, so. West side. Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at Grossen Farms. If you want to check that out, I'll give him a plug. Grossen Farms.
Grossen.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Back
to the
old Switzerland area. Yes, go ahead.
Do these people ever ship their lovely produce to old, crowded Portland town?
Don't know, but you could find out, I'll bet.
Yep.
Because the peaches that we pick up in the grocery store, I would hope that in Portland they'd be local as possible.
Well, try Food Front, Co-op, or Peoples. You know, they're ones that are more likely to get the...
And the farmers markets.
In the farmers markets, that's where you'll find, hopefully, locally grown fruit.
Yep.
And where did you say it is that you can get lovely tree-ripe and apricots that you can drive to?
So if you have a wonderful, beautiful drive out the Columbia River Gorge, just go to Highway 97, which is...
97. That's Mary Hill, did you say?
Yeah, across the river, and on the other side is a produce fruit stand.
Now, how far away is that from Portland, do you know?
Oh, I would say probably an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes. It's a drive.
A little closer than Kimberly, though.
Yeah, it's closer than Kimberly.
Yeah. Nicer than Kimberly too. It's so deserty out there, dry, deserty.
Well,
if they're growing peaches, it's probably down there in the valley. It's there's going to be some grass and stuff.
Okay,
it's pretty.
Where I lived once in San Jose. Do you remember anything about San Jose about 40, 50 years ago?
Haight Ashbury.
That was San Francisco.
No. San Jose. It was acres and acres and acres of orchards. And in the mornings, you could wake up if you lived in a little house and look out your window and see millions of butterflies flying above the lovely orchards out there. And I lived there about 20 years ago, and I actually used to ride my bicycle by an apricot tree. And oh my goodness, I knocked on the door of the little house and I said, may I please have a couple of your apricots? And she says, how much is a couple? I said, oh, three or four. She says, you can take 10. So I felt lucky.
I like that math.
And I picked them off the tree and ate them right there, and they were the best apricots I ever had.
Yeah, they're good. All right, we got to run.
I don't know how to grow them here.
Well, we're working on that.
Yeah, well, that's going to be coming up here. Yeah, right. So,
stay tuned.
You.
Thanks for calling. Okay, we still got Justin's on the phone. Good morning, Justin.
Hey, guys.
What you got?
Thanks for your awesome program. I did have an answer and to the question, and I also had a question about peaches.
Okay, go for it on both accounts.
The answer to the question is the cross is a plum and a peach to make a nectarine.
That's the common knowledge, but that's not the answer, the correct answer.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I'm just going to tell him here at some point. Right. I'll tell you here so nobody else is going to make that same thing, because it was a trick question. Fruits aren't a nectarine is not a cross between any two fruits.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
what an unfair question. I have to admit. Where's the buzzer?
Yeah. This is a thinking person's radio show here.
Right.
We don't spoon feed you anything. Except maybe tree ripened peaches. Okay, but we'll get to that after we answer your question about peaches.
I have a peach tree, and I started mulching it and putting, kind of developing a small compost around the base without suffocating the trunk. And it's thrived from last year, which didn't put on any fruit. And then all of a sudden this year it did. But this started fruiting a little bit. I noticed like 10 peaches, but they all ended up kind of falling off up until this point. So I don't know if that's something you've experienced, premature fruit falling off the peach tree.
Tell me what the foliage, the leaves look like, Justin.
They look healthy, actually. I'm not noticing any like peach curl. It's a dwarf peach tree.
Mm-hmm.
So it could have been that I just threw my Frisbee at it too many times on accident, or actually something has happened.
Well, how big were the peaches when they fell off? I mean, just walnut size?
Yeah, they're like the size of a penny or smaller, noticeable, basically.
Well, what I would suspect is just maybe lack of adequate fertilization, and they're just aborting.
Okay.
Peaches generally are self-fertile, Jim?
Yep. Yeah, there are some, however.
But they still need to get
pollen moved around.
Right. Yeah. Self-fertile, meaning that they're on the pollen comes from the same tree.
Okay.
But so insects still need to move it if you don't.
Yeah, that's one possibility. And also, do you have these is this in a pot or is it in the ground? It's in the ground, I guess you said, right?
Yeah, it's in the ground. It's maybe about 4 or 5 years old. Mm-hmm. So it's...
And it's,
yeah.
And it's is it flowered? This is the first time it flowered?
Correct.
Uh-huh.
And did you have more than 10 blooms?
No, there was a lot of flowers.
Yeah.
And I only just noticed those few peaches that actually came to fruition.
This is a coordinated monthly test of the emergency alert system through broadcast stations in the greater Portland-Vancouver area, including Clackamas, Columbia, Multnomah, and Washington counties in Oregon, and Clark County in Washington. With the cooperation of public safety broadcasters and cable operators, this system informs you of events that pose an immediate threat to your life, health, or property. If this had been an actual emergency, official information would have followed the alert tone. This test was originated by Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency in Vancouver, Washington. This concludes this test message.
back on? Okay, we're back.
Wow. Okay.
Let's take our first musical break, and all of these have to do with, all my selections have to do with smooth because of the nectarine.
good idea.
You know, somebody, I was gave a presentation to Master Gardener Group this weekend, and somebody said, I used to listen to your podcasts. Are you the one that plays the music too? So I like that. Anyway, this might also be able to describe Jim, because it's called Mr. Smooth.
In every city, whether it be large or small, his tired playlist drone. Some of us remember how much choice there was before he took the throne. He's Mr. Smooth, his hipness the great. For Mr. Smooth's verdict we must wait. So Mr. Smooth, when our turn comes round, dear Mr. Smooth, we only hope it won't be thumbs down. His power and reputation he earned cleverly. Play 15-second tracks, then just tape the electrodes to the average Joe to see how he reacts. He's Mr. Smooth, his hipness the great. For Mr. Smooth's verdict we must wait. So Mr. Smooth, when our turn comes round, dear Mr. Smooth, we only hope it won't be Thursday.
That's Michael Franks, one of my favorite vocalists. Been around for decades, but... Oh, my wife must be calling. She's got that same ring tone. That's not me. I silenced mine.
You know, I forgot, Glenn.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, I was kind of so late rushing in here. That...
Okay, yes, let's go to Sunny on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning. For those of us who are always working all the time and can't pay attention, are we almost at peach time?
Yes.
Is it right now?
Maybe some.
Could be a very early ripening ones. I would say we're still a little ways away from the main crop of peaches.
Just starting to come on. What are the dates that we should look for so that we can get out there and get our peaches?
To get them off your own tree or to get them to buy
them? To the nearby farm.
A U-pick or a farm stand. Say before the end of August.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's different varieties, but I would say starting at the end of July, peaches should be coming on pretty good, and probably through the month of August, for sure. I mean, the later ones will be and even into September.
Well, on the road to Canby, outside of Oregon City, there is a beautiful little peach farm that has the most delicious peaches I've ever eaten, and it's on the way down to Canby.
Just and 2 or 3 miles from Canby and on the west side of the 99.
The riverside.
I believe so. Yeah, yeah, they're good.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a great. I know the place well.
And they're very nice people.
Do they have a stand there?
Go pick. Or I'm not sure if it's a pick, but they certainly have lovely peaches, and their prices are good. And, really, really good peaches. And then Sauvie Island has always got lovely lovely peaches too, so that's not too far away, and they're worth the trip. So towards the end of July and through August, because we missed it last year, we got it the year before, and we want to make sure we don't miss it this year.
Yeah, and I haven't looked at the crop this year on our trees to see how they're doing. I'm a little concerned because we had that real wet cold spell in early April, and I know that some of the pollination didn't happen like it should, so but we'll find out. I honestly haven't checked to see what, how maybe some caller knows about how the peach crop here in the valley is.
That would be good to know. Yeah, it's certainly worth a stop by on that farm. If we're headed that way, we'll just check it out no matter what.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the heads up.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, Jim, you tell us how we do get nectarines. You can't read that either better than I can. Tammy, well, Tammy, can you, are you going to answer the phone there? Oh, yes, she is. Okay, well, I would like you to read what I have there. You've got your glasses on in the middle of the page there on my run sheet. It's in very small type.
Okay. And what am I reading?
That little paragraph there.
Oh, about a nectarine?
Yep.
Prunus persica variety nectarina.
That's it.
It's a fuzzy variety of peach.
Yeah.
It is not a cross between a peach and a plum. Fuzziness is a dominant trait of peaches. Occasionally, when peach trees are crossed or even self-pollinated, they will produce some fruit which whose seeds will grow into nectarine trees, and others which will be peach. What? And others which will be peach trees. Whoa. Nectarines will sometimes appear on peach trees, and peaches sometimes appear on nectarine trees. That's mind-blowing.
It is, and I appreciate you bringing your glasses today.
You're welcome.
It was worth it. Thank you.
Sure.
Right. Okay, yeah. So that's how we get a nectarine.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me. And in recent times, my partner Lorraine and I have been thinking about peaches and nectarines because the nectarine is really not just a smooth-skinned peach.
Agreed.
And it's a unique fruit of its own. It has unique flavor. It doesn't really, at least in my experience, develop. It doesn't have the same kind of texture that a peach does. It's juicy, but a peach kind of gets, I don't know what the right word would be, melting soft.
Yes.
And nectarines don't really quite get to that point. They don't do that same thing that a peach does in my in my experience. I think nectarines are really a significantly different fruit and lovely in their own way. We grow at our nursery both peaches and nectarines, and we have white and there's white flesh ones. There's white flesh nectarines as well as white flesh peaches. And of course the biggest issue, and this came up I think in our last show, somebody called too. But the biggest hassle growing on this side of the mountains in growing either peaches or nectarines is peach leaf curl, and they're both susceptible to it, and apricots aren't, and almonds aren't, and cherries aren't. So it's interesting that this—
They're all prunus.
Species, yeah. Mm-hmm. But only peaches and nectarines, as far as I know, get peach leaf curl.
Okay, so that's one of the drawbacks or the challenges of growing them, certainly not like apricots, which you never get fruit.
Right. Don't worry about peach leaf curl with apricots.
Right. So, you know, as far as growing it, you know, the normal things would apply, you know, more sun is better.
Sun is good.
And right. They need to be pruned every year. The rule of thumb is to take off about 2/3 of new growth on peaches because they...
Very vigorous.
And the peaches next year are forming now on the growth now.
Right.
And so not on old wood, so the tree just keeps getting bigger and bigger if you don't prune it.
Right. Yep. And I really recommend for homeowners, especially if you don't want to spray, search out ones that are resistant to peach leaf curl. That's like and there are some good ones out there.
That Oregon. Takes a lot of the hassle out of it. It's not leaf curl proof.
Yeah, they get resistant enough that it doesn't affect the crop, and that's what.
Yeah,
if you have a susceptible variety, you won't get fruit because the fruit will drop off along with the leaves curling up.
Yeah, which was a little different problem than what the previous caller had.
Right,
just small fruit that aborted.
Sounded like it. Yeah. Some people, an old strategy back in the day, if you had a dwarf peach, a really small one, there are some of those growing in a pot. You can put the pot underneath a edge of a roof or someplace, a porch or something, where it don't get rained on. And then you, because rain is what moves the peach leaf curl from bud to bud, and if the plant doesn't get wet, it won't happen. So you can get away with that.
But you could secure an umbrella to the stalk.
Sure,
a big umbrella.
Right,
or your upper leaves would be dry.
Yeah, one of those pretty University of Oregon ones,
But a good Oregon State, we don't want to.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. Or Portland State, for that matter, which is my alma mater.
Anybody. Yeah.
So, and you know, the best umbrella would be, this is an interesting idea, a peach leaf curl umbrella. We could market this, Glenn. So you want one that's translucent. You know, you want it to be let as much light through as possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that most umbrellas don't do that. So, I think this is interesting idea.
Yeah, that's what you need to do. I don't need another project.
It might work for beehives, special bee umbrellas.
Yeah, they're pretty good at taking care of themselves there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, so that's peaches and nectarines, our plant of the month. You want to meanwhile, let's touch on the apical dominance.
Sure. Yeah. So when we talk a lot about pruning. And whether it's pruning a small plant or a big plant or a really old plant or whatever, the principle of apical dominance, you will see it. And if you basically what it means is that the tip bud on a shoot exists some kind of auxins or some substance that
hormones. I'll kick it out there.
Yeah, that restrict the growth of the buds underneath. It's the dominant shoot, and it wants to grow, and it doesn't want competition. Apparently,
it gives trees its Christmas tree shape. We'll say.
Right. So a tree will grow up and not just become a little bush. So when you prune off that tip, then you allow the lateral buds that are below it to grow, or to grow more vigorously.
Right,
and so essentially that's usually desirable in most cases. In our nursery growing, we have trees that are growing up like a pear tree. What we do is we go through and we cut the tops off. We're talking thousands of trees, but we're just cutting the tops off so that the side branches will grow and make a branch tree, not just a spindly single stem tree.
Well, that's going to lead us right into espaliering here pretty soon, too.
How convenient.
So sometimes we want to do that. We want to allow more buds to present themselves.
Yes.
And sometimes we don't. Which is one difference between a heading cut and a thinning cut.
Right.
If you do a heading cut, which you just think about cutting the branch off, right below the head, then that's what Jim was talking about there. You cut the top off and it allows those other buds to grow.
Right.
But for the most part, for example, on espalier pruning, you wouldn't want to make really those cuts because you want to take it all the way back, the pruning cut back to the stem or the trunk or some major crotch.
Because you're thinning.
We don't want more branches coming out. Espalier is, I sometimes say it's a French term for torture.
Hmm. Torture your tree.
Right, because we're forcing it to be to conform to our whatever shape we want. Hmm. I'm on my espaliers, I have them at 45 degrees. Oftentimes they're horizontal, and then at the ends they'll come up, called a candelabra, or you can just let your imagination go wild. But you do have to, be proficient in pruning for that. And now this, before we go to our phone call, this is a good time for me to talk about what annoys me. Our new feature. I'm going to get a theme song on this one. But it annoys me that for some reason and somehow nurseries have started calling their combo fruit trees, that is to say, they might have four varieties that they, and Jim's rolling his eyes here on this. Maybe it annoys him too, or maybe I'm annoying him. But just because they have a combo tree and they have them going out horizontal doesn't make it an espalier. It's somewhat called become anonymous. Synonymous, that if you buy these combo trees that have four varieties generally of apples or whatever, that they call them espalier. What do you think, Jim?
I don't think they understand French.
Well, that's it, maybe.
Right. Well, we used to grow combo trees. They're a pain because you know, a combo tree, you go out and you put four different varieties on, and then one doesn't grow. Then you've got three, and then what three are they? And it's a pain. It's a total pain.
Okay.
But espalier is a training method.
Yeah.
And it does nothing to do with the combo part. If we used to grow espaliers too, and that's another job because you've got to train those lower branches.
Right.
I mean, all the branches have to become horizontal, and it makes a really interesting and beautiful tree, but it's totally different than a combo. A combo essentially is just a branched apple tree with each branch a different variety.
Yeah.
Or apple or whatever it is.
So I'm getting it that annoys you too.
Well, I haven't actually been around the retail scene enough to see the marketing.
Well,
that
I'm even at the beyond that, you know, with the purchaser. Mm-hmm. And then they come to me and they say, "Can you fix this?"
Oh, really?
Or what do we do with this now? Or they'll say, "I have an espalier."
Yeah.
And then I get talking to him. Well, you just have a combo. It hasn't been anyway.
Yeah. Typically, in an espalier tree, the branches start out pretty low. So your first tier of branches are probably no more than 2 feet above the ground. And then you've got another tier, maybe another foot to foot and a half above that. And the trees, when you purchase an espalier tree in a nursery, it's already trained. So those branches are out. It takes a couple of years to do that for them to get out to the side. So they're quite different.
Indeed. That's my point.
Yeah. Good point, Glenn.
Okay.
Okay.
We got a quorum on that. All right. Let's go to the phone. Amber has called. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for your show. I love it. I put it on my calendar so I won't miss it.
Oh, great. Yeah, you need to do that once a month.
Yeah. Okay, well, I have a tomato plant in a pot that a friend gave me. And excuse me. He's a gardener, so I figured he knew all about it. And, you know, I grew tomatoes in the past, but gave up on them for different reasons. But anyway, I don't have to talk about that. Okay, what's going on with it is the leaves are very, very green and big and tough leaves. And some of the leaves around the bottom and starting to move up the plant have started to curl up on the edges and also had a few bright colored yellow spots on them, and I got those off of there right away and even tore the spots off of a couple of leaves, but not too bad yet. It is starting to get little tomatoes on it, but what I'm wondering is this a fungus, you think, and what do I need to spray on it? I did, or due to it, maybe needs a nutrient. We have a really good garden shop across the river in Hood River, and it's called Good News Garden. Anyway, they have a lot of different, you can buy a little box of a certain nutrient. Well, I'm wondering if it needs something like that added to the dirt.
What size of a pot is it?
It's probably around 10 inches wide, and it's pretty tall, maybe, I don't know, a foot and a half tall or something like that.
Well, it's unlikely that it's a disease.
Mm.
A fungal disease. Well, it's something, but it's nothing to worry about, I don't think, particularly since you've pruned it off. Blight is what we normally would expect on tomatoes, but not this early and when it's been this dry.
Oh, yeah. Well, it looks like the soil dries out every day. It looks maybe it's...
Well, I meant the weather.
Potting soil, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a pretty good-sized pot. Mm-hmm. For an annual, and that seems to be fine. You said the leaves are, for the most part, green. And what kind of a tomato is it?
I don't know. I should have gotten more information from
him. Is it a cherry tomato?
I'm not sure. No, I don't. It's special for patios and such.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
But well, I don't think it's anything
worth
it. No.
I asked him what to put in. He said, all kinds of good stuff and sand and different stuff. So he made his own mixture.
Okay.
But that didn't tell me anything.
Yeah, well, the fact that the plant looks healthy, it seems to me that you wouldn't have to be dealing with this soil other than the moisture. And, mm-hmm. you know, it might need, if it's in a sunny spot, it might need water every day.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing.
Especially coming up this week.
Yeah, and then white salmon, we've been getting wind, too, and that dries them out real fast.
Yeah, well, just watch for that. You know, if the plant gets under stress, then it can't ward off diseases as well. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. what you've done is fine to remove the infected right. spots, and I think it'll be fine.
Okay, you don't think there's any, except for maybe being too dry, because by evening then it's right. dry again.
Oh, yeah, well, then mm-hmm. water it, yeah. Put a mm-hmm. put a saucer under it to catch a little yeah. bit of the water so it doesn't dry
it
out.
It has one, but I never saw any water in there.
okay, well, water it more then. Particularly.
Yeah, well.
Okay, very good.
Okay, I have another little question. Do I have time?
Yep, quickly.
Okay. I've been gardening here for about 6 years, and a lot of my plants have sort of white spots on them. They're not real prominent, but they're just whitish looking. And it's on a lot of things, and I'm wondering what the heck that is.
Have you got edible plants or bushes? Or
all kinds, herbs and flowers.
White spots on the leaves?
Yeah.
It could be powdery mildew or...
Well, are they can rub them off, or are they in the leaf itself?
No, it doesn't really rub off.
Huh. But it's not...
Butterfly bush there in the front too, and these plants are all together, and the butterfly bush, now some of the leaves are on the bottom, have started to turn yellow, so I'm going to give it some fertilizer too, because the butterflies and hummingbirds are on it right now. I use organic fertilizers.
Yeah. I don't know what it might be if it's not a mm-hmm. I mean, it's, I see, you know, amounts of powdery mildew, you know, usually not this soon.
Mm-mm, it's not that. I had some on mint plants. They were in the shade.
Could it be insect damage, like stippling from a sucking insect, like aphids, or?
No, I don't really think so.
Well, has it hurt the plant, or just unsightly?
No, it's unsightly.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't think they're vigorous, the ones that have it on. I don't think they're vigorous enough.
Give them more water, too. And while you're at it, rinse off the plant.
Okay. Yeah. I do that to the butterfly bush. I know. I heard somewhere that they like water, so I do that to them.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sure.
Okay.
Kind of struck out on that one anyway. All right. Let's talk about your trip to New Jersey for the apricots.
Yeah. This was an epic journey. Seems like many of the ones we've taken recently are. And of course, most a lot of our trips, we go overseas to look for things, but you can do fruit exploring right here in the
sure.
U.S. And so we've met this apricot breeder named Joe Gofreda, who works for Rutgers University. And they've got a farm sort of probably in the middle of the state. And
is this a Rutgers farm? Or
it's a Rutgers farm,
okay. mm-hmm.
right. And Joe is just interested in apricots, and they also do peach. He does peach breeding, but I think his real passion is apricots. So it's really fun to go
well,
there.
It's an untapped market here, anyway.
Yeah, and there too, he's actually trying to make a commercial apricot. Make it viable commercially. So we've been working with him now for a couple of years, and this was the first chance we had to go out and actually try apricots when they were ripe. Now, I'm sure that there are some listeners who, growing up, or know people from that part of the world, and if they do or know, have that experience, they know why you don't go to New Jersey in July. But we did, because that's where we had to go, and it was hot and it was humid, and for about 3 hours, it was I was like ready to go inside. But the eating the apricots was wonderful. I mean, the diversity was amazing. Ones that were crunchy kind of and sweet, like you wouldn't think, you know, the ones that we get here typically, I just bought some yesterday, big apricots, you know, but they're not ripe,
and they're not going to be ripe,
and so these ones were ripe, and they were still firm. And which
with
was
the
really
ones that you ate there, were they on the tree?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
we
just
rode,
we walked around in this multiple acre experimental block, uh-huh. and sampled apricots, and they had planted a lot of them from different parts of the world, mostly seedlings, to test them out. And they also have done some breeding, and they've released some varieties, which we're experimenting with at our place.
And for our listeners, a seedling is one that was planted from a seed?
Yes. So they gathered, they got seeds from Uzbekistan, and I'm not sure exactly where else. That was their main, in Russia.
These weren't grafts or clones from
these,
them.
These were seedlings. Seedlings, right. And they had, you know, they weren't, most of the seedlings weren't themselves commercial quality, although for us out here, I mean, I tell Lorraine, I said, look, you know, if we had an apricot that you can, that tastes good, even if it's the size of a quarter, you know, that's really good.
Well, you'd want to
really
keep looking, but.
Yeah, right, exactly. But, you know, so our standards here, our threshold is pretty small, low. And the climate in New Jersey, they get a lot of summer rain, and it's humid, and it's not like dry steppe climates like the Central Asia and places where it just never rains at all.
Well, what were his steps that he was taking to get these apricots given those conditions? Was he?
Nothing special was being done to them. They did do some spraying apparently of fungicide in the fall. But really not a lot, and basically these trees, the ones that have survived, a lot of them have died. I mean, they planted them out at two foot, you know, all these seedlings they got, they planted them 2 feet apart, and now I mean, there are big spaces between them because a lot of them didn't make it. But the ones that did make it, you know,
it seems like he's on his way.
Yeah, and as I said, they've released a number of varieties for trial, which we're experimenting with. And
did you have any swag? did you get any trees or cuttings or seeds?
Well, we've made arrangements to get the cuttings in August. We'll bud them onto our rootstock, and then grow them out at our place. We've committed a good size experimental area for apricot
at your home
at the nursery,
because you're doing one at the Goldendale.
Goldendale is strictly Seabury at this point.
Oh, Seabury, excuse me. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, I mean it's the location's not so great for apricot where that Seabury experiment is. But down, because higher elevation, the lower elevation along the river is where the apricots are. But of course, we don't really need to plant them there for tests because we know they're going to grow.
Right. Good point.
Yeah.
We've got one call. You want to, Jared? Good morning, Jared. We got time for a quick question.
All right. Well, actually, I was just going to recommend that with pots, it's good to put like a cardboard up or something to shield it from the sun. To not cook the roots, and I don't know if that's what maybe that lady's dealing with, but just protect the pots from getting too hot.
Yeah, that could
mess with the roots.
That could be.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, most pots are black, and they definitely get hot.
Yeah, and that's all I wanted to say.
All right, good point. That was quick.
So, yeah, thank you.
All right, I'll bet you she's still listening. Thank you.
Yeah. So
okay,
well, more on apricot to come. But we actually had had some harvest this year of some fruit from ones that we had grafted last year. They bore in 1 year, which was pretty amazing.
Wow! And when was that? When did you harvest the fruit?
Right now.
Oh,
I just picked some up this morning.
Oh, but you didn't bring any.
Well, you know, the thing is they're very, very special fruit.
Well, yes, I can understand that.
They're not really, I'm talking three fruit, you know, when the seeds from those are like gold, you know, or the family jewels. So
the seeds would be good?
We're going to plant the seeds.
Oh,
yeah.
Just to see.
To see what we get from those. Because every, you know, more, there's two ways of doing this. I mean, one is to find an existing variety that will work here, and the other is to create our own, and we're trying both angles.
I would have given you back the seed.
I know.
Okay.
I thought about it, but we have to actually do a little taste test at home too.
Well, that reminds me that I was going to bring in some of my yellow raspberries, and they've just, for one, they're what I call flea bitten now. But the spotted wing Drosophila I don't look at my fruit when I eat it.
Wow.
I mean, there's that much. But the biggest problem that I've been having for 2 years now with these yellow ones is crumbly fruit. Do you have any?
No, they actually fall apart, huh?
Yeah.
Like little segments.
Yeah, the little droops, as they're called.
Yeah.
They'll be crumbly.
Wow.
And not nearly as large. You know, I'm thinking, well, maybe I need to give it more water. I don't know.
That's a new one to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, my other varieties are doing pretty well. All right, so a little bit of housekeeping here. We will not be here next month.
You're going down to Junction City?
That's right. I will have my food booth there at the Scandinavian Festival.
Well,
and if you're looking for good food and entertainment, the food costs, but not the entertainment, 4 days.
What are the dates?
Well, it's Thursday through Sunday. I think it's the 10th through the 13th. Is that Thursday through Sunday? I don't have that memorized in my mind yet, but it's around there.
I'd love to come down. I hope I can make it.
One of my brothers and I have this booth where we serve Swedish pancakes and lefse. But this will be year number 40.
That's
if we don't have it down now, we won't.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you put fruit in these?
We do. Strawberries, wild blackberries, lingonberries.
Oh, man.
Or my favorite, old butter and sugar.
Wow. Where do you get the lingonberries?
We buy those.
Yeah,
they're from Sweden.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, no more chit-chat.
Yeah.
So we will be back in September.
Yeah, and I'm going to go to China on September 14th. I think
it'll have to be before then.
I think the show will be before then.
Well, it could be on the 14th, but maybe just catch the show on the way to your airport.
Right, stop by.
Okay, we're out of time. We're past out of time. Sorry about that. Tammy, thanks. You're the best. This is Glenn Andreessen.
This is KBOO Portland. It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Wednesday, July 11th, 2018. This morning, outside the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Building in Portland, federal officers arrested 7 protesters. The 7 people arrested were trying to block a van transporting immigrants from the facility to take to Tacoma, Washington Detention Center. Through the night, the protesters at Occupy ICE worked to assist a woman whose husband was taken into the facility for deportation. According to the woman, her husband was a legal resident who had submitted